Enjoy the convenience of 7 days a week banking and extended hours with Cube from First Arkansas Bank and Trust, member FDIC.
In the World Series seven times between 1941 and 1956, the Yanks won six of them.
The Dodgers were looking up from below as the team that wanted to be the Yankees.
But when they kept losing to the Yankees, them bums came out. You know, those bums lost again. So the saying was, you know, we'll wait till next year. And of course, 55 was next year.
And the borough of Brooklyn went crazy.
Frenzied excitement on the field.
You'd have thought all those people had inherited the earth.
But then, after the 1957 season, the Dodgers moved to Los Angeles, thus ending a neighborhood rivalry and a way of life.
You continued the Yankee-Dodger tradition, only it didn't quite mean the same thing.
Soon, the togetherness that had defined post-war America for so many was shattered by the tumult of the 1960s. And then came what Tom Wolfe, the great American satirist, would label the me decade, the 70s.
Just the mere fact that all eyes are on me is a tremendously appealing thing to have happen.
Tom Wolfe was thinking about the vapid qualities of the culture and the perils of this type of lifestyle. It's focusing on yourself and me leads to a big dead end because you're losing the sense of culture, sense of community, sense of everyone else.
Why do we have these rules about divorce? Why do we have these rules about pornography? People were kicking over all the constraints that had held families together, that had held communities together.
New York in 1977, in so many ways, embodied those fractures.
It was broke. It was desperate. It was a despair almost to the city.
New York City back in the 70s was sliding right into the abyss. There was a fiscal crisis going on.
New York at that time was out of control. Cops were being disrespected and assaulted. There were 2,000 murders a year. It was lawless.
The violence of David Berkowitz as the Son of Sam was rampant.
This is a police sketch of a suspect in one of the nastiest murder cases in a long time.
The killer has struck six times since last summer, most of them pretty young women. The killer's eighth attack came on this lonely street in Brooklyn.
That an animal should snuff away a life of a young girl.
The police are no closer than ever to catching the madman.
Fear is spreading.
Meanwhile, at Studio 54, a new kind of hedonism was fueled by cocaine and champagne, as temperatures soared to record highs in the summer of 77.
And then we had the blackout.
Like a swarm of locusts, the looters ripping through whole blocks of stores within a couple of hours after the lights went out.
The blackout meant the city had lost control of its power grid.
We've seen our citizens subjected to violence, vandalism, theft, and discomfort.
It makes you really want to throw up when you look at what's happened. And we got to live here. There's no place for us to go.
I couldn't believe that the city that I love, I grew up in, family, friends, cousins, aunts, and uncles, felt like it was just falling apart. You know, smell the smoke, you know, in the atmosphere.
And the subways, they were like, they stink, the graffiti.
You couldn't see out the side windows because they were covered with graffiti.
You were constantly fearing that you would be victimized.
As for Los Angeles, it was hardly the paradise that so many migrating Americans had envisioned a few decades earlier.
The thrill of Southern California is in the air.
By the end of the 60s, you had Charles Manson. Going into the 70s, you had a recession that hit California particularly hard. Growing freeway congestion, problems with pollution. And then you had the energy crisis. Los Angeles was built around cheap auto fuel. It was a great time of disillusionment. almost a sense of paradise lost.
Back the previous winter, free agency had begun in baseball. Players no longer held down by contracts that bound them to their clubs interminably. But freedom would have a number of ripple effects.
The New York people have put a lot of support behind the Yankees and have put a lot of money into our ball club, supporting us at the gate, drew over 2 million people, and we're determined to give it back and in the form of players. And I want to put the best team on the field that I can. That's what I'm in the business for. Anybody that says they're not should get out.
Steinbrenner was a man who wanted what he wanted and was willing to pay for it. And free agency fit in very well with his time period.
Yankee manager Billy Martin wanted to bring three-time All-Star Joe Rudy to New York. But Yankee owner George Steinbrenner had his eyes set on Reggie Jackson, the most feared slugger in the game.
There's a long drive. That one is going way up. It is off the roof. That hit the transformer up there.
Jackson had been at the center of the Oakland A's dynasty earlier in the decade and was still square in the prime of his career. While the Yankees hadn't won a World Series since 1962, 11 years before Steinbrenner had bought the team.
He was concerned about making the team a champion. And Thurman Munson has said, if you want to get the guy to help us win, go get the big guy out of Oakland. George took us around town. People recognized him and people recognized me. Stopped on the streets, waved. A bus driver stopped, got out of his bus in a turn in the street in full traffic, shook my hand and got back on the bus. Just a great experience. We then went to a restaurant called 21. The who's who of the city, business guys and great wealth, and you know, they did their best to talk me to come to New York.
The pitch was that with his charisma and charm, Reggie could own the town, be bigger than he already was.
Billy was absolutely fit to be tied. Billy Martin wanted a right-handed batter for that lineup. And he also knew that Reggie Jackson had an incredibly big mouth. And Billy hated players who tried to show him up.
Jackson signed for $2.9 million over 5 years with the Yankees in November 1976. Second only on the club to Catfish Hunter. "I didn't come here to become a star," Reggie said when he signed. "I brought my star with me."
My initial reaction was kind of like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm going to be playing with Reggie Jackson. Because, I mean, I grew up, you know, idolizing those kind of guys. And I kind of felt like he was a missing piece.
Not everyone in Pinstripes felt that way. Like Martin, Mickey Mantle's old teammate, and a pal who had fulfilled a dream by becoming the Yankee manager 2 seasons earlier.
I think Billy Martin always thought of himself as an underdog. He was undersized to be a major league player. He always had a sort of prove and prove plus that he had what it took, first as a player and then as a manager.
Billy played on world championship clubs with some of the best Yankee players ever wear a uniform. So he knew what it meant to be winners.
I thought he was a magician on the field. He really knew the game. He knew how to get you winning because that's what he was all about.
He was General MacArthur inside the dugout, 2-3 innings ahead, anticipating what was coming. The mind of a genius when it came to baseball.
That mind had earned Martin a reputation for turning around teams quickly, which he'd done in his three previous stops over 7 seasons as a manager in Minnesota, Detroit, and Texas.
I think that the game should be aggressive. You should play hard, ask for no ground, give no ground, and I'll do anything to win a ball game.
But he also had a tendency to wear out his welcome.
This little inferiority complex was enhanced by the fact that he never seemed to age. He didn't turn gray, he didn't get paunchy. so he could look at himself in the mirror in the morning and still see a 22-year-old.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQBar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
Your old brat, ready to go out and do combat. He was still Billy the Kid.
He was his own worst enemy. If he would just get out of his own way, he could go down as one of the greats.
Play ball, says the ump, and there go the...
Back in a Yankees-Kansas City Athletics game in 1956, a former Dodger pitcher trying to hang on in the big leagues named Tommy Lasorda had set out to intimidate the Bombers lineup, throwing towards Billy Martin's head. Benches emptied, punches flew, Martin and Lasorda in the middle of the brawl, but somehow coming out of it as friends.
We have to do everything we can to keep the violence out of the game, because we've always believed in that passage of the Bible, love thy neighbor, love thy friend,
everybody.
Right.
Tommy was a guy who liked to pick a fight, too. But the fundamental difference was Tommy wanted to be your pal. Have you met Bob Newhart, Roy?
Tommy was in his first full year as the manager of the Dodgers in 1977. A rookie at age 49.
It's a celebrity culture, and athletes were just about as big a celebrity as any movie star there. And when it came to the Dodgers, those worlds intersected. Tommy Lasorda had A-listers in his office after every game.
He would have an Italian restaurant from Little Italy in L.A. cater his office.
Sinatra and Rickles used to come all the time.
Jim Brown and Richard Roundtree and Fred the Hammer Williams and
Jonathan Winters.
Cary Grant.
Ella Fitzgerald had seats right by the Dodger dugout.
Tommy, you better pitch a good game tonight.
I'm sitting there having pasta with Danny Kaye 45 minutes before the ball game.
See these three guys right here? They're all ex-Yankee managers.
No one loved being Tommy Lasorda more than Tommy Lasorda. He'd come up through the Dodger organization, bled Dodger blue, treated his players like they were his own sons, loyal to a fault. He liked to say that when you joined the Dodgers, you were entering Lasorda University.
I think everybody in life needs a pat on the back.
Was he a good manager? Yes. Was he a character? Yes.
He makes you want to play. He makes it fun when you come to the ballpark. It's not a job, it's a game.
I think he tried to be a manager and a coach and a father and a priest and a rabbi. All the things that Tommy thought he had to do, that was Tommy.
I think he was the first real psychologist as a manager.
Somebody said, how do we beat the Dodgers? I said, who's keeping from hugging each other? Because they're the ones that started that hugging crap, you know. Now everybody hugs everybody.
I'm like the father who sits at the head of the table and looks at his family and sees the love and understanding and togetherness. He beams with pride. That's the way I am with this ball club.
I had a game in Atlanta, and I pitched horribly. Well, I came in, and I lost. I threw my glove, and I kicked stuff. And Lasorda says, cool off, go upstairs, take a shower. After the game, be in my office. He could have trashed me. And I had it coming. But he said, you're my pitcher. You're my best pitcher. We're going to win this year. And the reason we're going to win is because of you.
Dodgers at least publicly tried to parade themselves as we love each other. In the clubhouse and in the dugout, it wasn't that much fun.
Steve Irwin,
baseball player. Yeah, that's right. He has made a few people angry with the goody-goody guy.
There were issues involving marital relationships and personalities and who was a leader and who was a phony leader.
Well, it was apple pie, the flag, and baseball and God. I mean, those were the things I believed in.
Okay, Garvey, let's move it. But Tom, I'm hungry, and my Swanson Hungry Man entree tastes so good.
He liked the adulation, and Los Angeles is a place with lots of adulation around. I think it fit him well.
He was so clean-cut. That part didn't bother his teammates, but the fact that he judged them for their misdeeds in terms of cursing or drinking or carousing rubbed them the wrong way.
Maybe his personality is just completely different from everyone else's, and it's something that people are not accustomed to seeing.
The Dodgers started the 1977 season 22-4. Chavez Ravine became the hottest ticket in town.
This was L.A., it was Southern California, it was Hollywood, and then walking into this theater known as Dodger Stadium. Every day was an unscripted play. It was amazing.
From that point on, it was, let's have fun, boys.
Meanwhile, back east, with the signing of Jackson, the Yankees now had every piece in place to win a World Series and avenge their sweep by the Cincinnati Reds in the 76 Fall Classic.
This could be it. Left field, George Foster, Geronimo Foster makes the catch. That's it. The Cincinnati Reds win the World Series in four straight.
We had gone to the World Series the year before. Sure, we got beat by the Reds, but we were there. We had a pretty good team.
Although they'd lost the 76 World Series and George Steinbrenner felt this is the guy that's going to make the difference, Billy thought his managing makes the difference, not having Reggie Jackson in the lineup.
When Steinbrenner dropped him into the clubhouse, he turned things sideways in terms of the chemistry. There were a lot of people who felt, why are you even bringing him in?
The clubhouse was full of resentment, full of backbiting. Munson resented Reggie because George Steinbrenner wooed Reggie Jackson to the finest restaurants in New York before he signed as a free agent. Thurman Munson never even had a lunch with George Steinbrenner.
He was a humble guy, hardworking guy. New York is identified with those kind of guys.
There aren't any superstars in this ball club. Everybody in this ball club are guys that like to go out and work. And if you don't like to work, then you're not going to fit in here.
So there was pressure. There was intensity. There was a lot of hate.
It was tough. It was tough. First year was tough. A lot of stuff went on, man.
In the offseason, Yankee owner George Steinbrenner gambled millions in an effort to build a world champion. The problem is that big egos go with big dollars, and there are reports of serious dissension on the team.
I think he wasn't accepted in the beginning. We saw that that he liked to talk to the press a lot. He was kind of a magnet. We just let him do it.
We didn't have to worry about talking to reporters in the clubhouse because they were all around him.
In the past, reporters never wrote about anything beside the ball games, and now they saw the George, Reggie, Billy triangle. They had that to write about every single day.
I think the important thing here is for us to win it all, and we have to keep the other problems or the other things that they're trying to create down to a minimum.
Yeah, there was some friction there. I didn't notice it right away, you know, because I was new. Then I started hearing bits and pieces. And I go, oh boy, you know, here we go.
The Yankees stumbled out of the gate in the 1977 season, starting out just 2-8.
You've got Jackson and Munson and Chris Chambliss, and, you know, much of the heart of the Orioles has not been hitting.
Then came the interview Reggie gave to Sport Magazine, published in late May.
He's interviewed by Sport Magazine, and Reggie shows his true self.
And the magazine arrives in the Yankee clubhouse with all this criticism of Thurman Munson.
He says that he's the straw that stirs the drink. And that wasn't bad enough. What he then did was say, and Thurman Munson can only stir it bad.
And that sent shockwaves through the Yankees because Munson was beloved.
And Reggie responds like, I never said all that stuff.
You know, this was misquoted. And Thurman said, for 3,000 freaking words? No, I know. I thought that was one of the great quotes of all time.
That just really brutally destroyed Reggie's standing.
And after that statement Reggie made, it's just like, he's better than the captain. The captain was a great guy.
And that and his personality just rubbed people the wrong way. I mean, he came over there and thought he was going to be better than everybody else, and we didn't need that.
I don't think that all this, this backstabbing stuff that they've been reading is good for anybody. We're a good ball club. We had our troubles to begin with. We'll eventually get everything going together, and we'll eventually win it all. We don't need this type of articles that have been coming out.
It was entertaining, but it was also dysfunctional. There were a handful of prominent but quiet players like Bucky Dent, Chris Chambliss, Roy White. But they were kind of like the chorus, you know, they would just sit back and observe what was going on with all the other characters.
We even dreaded going in the locker room because the tension was so high. If he hit a home run, everybody ran out and shook his hand. But when we got in the clubhouse, it was like, okay, you go your way, I go my way.
A lot of times you become surly or become very moody just to try to protect yourself or to try to have some peace of mind or try to have some time alone.
So you start the season in 77 with a guy who basically is shunned by the entire ball club.
Reggie didn't have many friends on the team. It was probably myself and Fran Healy. It was the only two guys that talked to him.
I had an expression. If you could do it all over again, Reggie, would you fall in love with yourself?
The Yankees' 1977 strife went from bad to worse on a June road trip to Boston.
Billy
apparently thought I had not hustled on the ball. Rice was the hitter, and so you had to play him deep. Ball jammed him a little bit, hit a flare to right field, and I stepped back on the ball at first and then ran in after it.
That ball was hit in no man's land. I went back on it, and I knew that the Wild Rays were going to catch it.
Rice gets credited for a double, and all of a sudden, Billy exploded.
I was sitting right next to Billy. Billy said that he wasn't hustling, and Billy just screamed out, "Blair, right field!"
I can see Paul Blair getting up to go get his glove, and I'm like, oh my goodness, he's going to do this? I mean, is he going to take Reggie Jackson out of this game? Are you kidding me right now?
Martin walked to the mound, ostensibly just to change pitchers. "Watch this," he said to Mike Torres and Thurman Munson. "I'm going to get that son of a bitch."
Then Billy sent Paul Blair in to take me out of the game.
When I saw Blair start jogging out, I was like, oh, here we go. Here we go, right?
I kind of didn't get it.
Reggie Jackson has been taken out of the game.
Most managers would have went at the end of the inning, but I think Billy wanted to humiliate him, take him out of the game on national TV.
The tensions that had been festering for months were finally going to explode.
As I came down the stairs, Billy said, "If you embarrass me, I'm going to embarrass you." And I was like, "Really? What did I do?"
Oh, look at this. Look at Billy. Is he hot?
When Reggie is taking his glasses off, I said, oh my God, and I don't want to look.
All of a sudden, Elston gets up and Yogi gets up. He takes a step and he takes a step.
When are they going to start swinging on one another?
That may be the first time I've ever seen that.
And Reggie says, "Yeah, come on, old man. What are you going to do?"
I said, "All that alcohol you drink must have gone to your brain."
"What? You calling it? Oh, I'll kill you."
Billy wants to get at Reggie. And that's in full view of the crowd being restrained by Yogi Berra.
Billy
didn't like Reggie, and for some reason, I got the feeling he didn't like me. And he used to pinch hit for me all the time. Billy had pinch hit for me in the seventh inning. So I went up in the clubhouse, and I was getting dressed, and we heard the yelling and the screaming. Reggie come running up the tunnel and throws his glove, and, you know, he's mad, you know. He goes, "You see what he did to me?"
Reggie changed. He took his time because he wanted to see if Billy was actually going to come down to the clubhouse, and we'll get it on right here.
At that time, Fran Healy came in. He said, "Reggie, you need to get dressed and go home. Because if not, he's going to come right up the runway, and you're going to get in a fight. He'll sucker punch you. You fight him back, and you're going to lose. No matter what happens, you're going to be a loser in a steal." And so right around the top of the ninth inning, I changed my street clothes, didn't shower, and walked back to the hotel. And really the best decision I ever made. One of the best decisions I ever made.
The next day, Yankee general manager Gabe Paul met with Billy and Reggie to try to broker peace. It did not go well. Billy repeated his claim about Reggie not hustling. Reggie insisted he did. Billy called him a liar and said, "Get up, boy. I'm going to kick the shit out of you right here." The meeting was over, and Reggie didn't need to be told what boy meant.
Tough. It was tough. It was tough. I asked to be traded. I asked out. It was, you know, it was weird and awkward. It's not fun to talk about it, you know, because it just brings up stuff and you kind of want to forget.
Today, we're...
Hey, did you miss Clinton and Friends?
Dodger Drew in New Mexico. You're on with Clinton Yates and David Dennis Jr.
How you doing, gentlemen? If I can't glean you for a minute, I'm lucky enough to be able, in my work, to listen to the whole lineup, you know, unsportsmanlike, you guys' eyes and whatnot. Clinton, you guys put on the best product. I'm glad you're getting some recognition on the big show. I love your show.
Clinton and Friends, weekdays from 10 to noon Eastern on ESPN Radio and on the ESPN app. Amber and Ian.
I have had this discussion with many a parent. Anybody who tells me that on a day in, day out basis, you don't have a favorite child, you're full of crap. Tell me right now, who's your favorite kid today?
My favorite kid today? I don't know if I have one today.
That's a blatant lie. I'm looking right at you.
Amber and Ian, weeknights at 7 Eastern on ESPN Radio. The Rich Eisen Show.
Frank Caliendo. I'd like to ask Adam Schefter, what is the meaning of Christmas?
Well, according to my sources, at this particular time, it appears that Christmas is about giving. It is the giving season. And according to my sources, deck the halls with boughs of holly. According to my sources, fa la la la.
The Rich Eisen Show, from noon to 3 Eastern on ESPN Radio, ESPN Plus, and on Disney Plus.
Back in Los Angeles in August of 1977, the Dodgers fell into a slump. Their pitching staff struggling. The team losing the momentum they'd built up in the spring.
Look, it's a long season, and when you're losing, of course, things get much worse. You know, the trips are too long. Where's the bus? How come my luggage isn't here? The food is horrible. Tensions mount.
These were all great guys, but they were all really competitive. Publicly, they presented themselves as a family. And interestingly, a lot of them came up all at the same time.
Like their manager, Tommy Lasorda, the infield had all played in the minors for the Dodgers for years. Steve Garvey was at first for the big club, Davey Lopes at second, Bill Russell at shortstop, Ron Say at third, and Steve Yeager as the catcher.
You had a lot of disparate personalities. To me, it made sense they weren't all necessarily the best of friends off the field. Ron Say is a little prickly. Davey Lopes was acerbic. He could be very confrontational. He was the captain. Russell was a Midwesterner who felt a little out of place with these big personalities.
They knew how to push each other's buttons, and they knew, you know, they knew what they didn't like about that other person.
Say didn't like Garvey. Yeager didn't like Garvey. Garvey didn't like Sutton.
Garvey had got a lot of advertising endorsements, which, you know, ticked off a number of players.
This is Sega Vision.
I probably had a deeper understanding than most of my teammates that we are in a entertainment business, subcategory baseball, and that if you play the game, it's important to interact with the fans, it's important to promote your organization and the game, and that's what I did. Tommy, in his own inimitable way, did the same thing, so I think that's why he and I were probably more of the face of the franchise, more of the two guys that the press would go to.
Lasorda once remarked, "If Steve came to date my daughter, I'd lock the door and not let him out."
And I think we're really trying to do what's best for baseball.
One particular episode, a reporter asked him, "Do you think you have a shot at the MVP?" And in 77, Ron Say had better stats than Garvey did through most of the season. And Ron Say was quoted saying, "I don't know what it takes to get noticed by these guys."
The real world of professional sports, big contracts, and petty jealousies, it was all a blunt contrast to Garvey's fairy tale baseball roots.
Growing up in Florida, you know, I was around spring training. Dad was a Dodger fan, Mom was a Yankee fan.
It's spring in Florida and spring training in Vero Beach.
Lo and behold, the end of spring training in 1956, Dad working for Greyhound, he says, "Tomorrow I've got a charter to pick up the Brooklyn Dodgers to take him to St. Pete to play the Yankees in a spring training game. You want to go?" "Wow, Dad, yeah." So I'm 7 years of age. I got a chance to bat boy. I was around the boys of summer for the Dodgers, around the great Yankees. It was quite a first day of being baptized into baseball.
Jackie Robinson takes his cut, as does slugging Gil Hodges.
Gil Hodges was his idol, and he saw Gil Hodges embrace the fans, talk to them, sign autographs. He saw himself in that mold.
A story out of a baseball fantasy. But the reality was that young Steve Garvey's early life was hardly perfect.
Of course, he was an only child, and he had that relationship with his grandmother.
Both his parents worked, leaving him at home to care for his disabled grandmother, feeding her, cleaning her, caring for her. A young boy forced to become a man.
Garvey had a tough life growing up, but Garvey pretended it never happened.
There was no pretending for Reggie Jackson. He was raised just outside Philadelphia. His memories included the times he had to rely on a friend to pick up and drop off his girlfriend. She was white, and Reggie needed the cover.
I was born in a small town in Pennsylvania, not really segregated, but I was black kid, colored kid. There were places I couldn't go and friends that their parents didn't want me to play with.
You're not welcome here.
His parents divorced when he was 6 years old. He was raised primarily by his father.
His dad ran a tailor shop down there. Reggie and two brothers lived upstairs.
Hard work ethic, off your butt and on your feet in the morning, get up and do something.
He was always very good about doing anything I asked him.
Take his belt off and give you a whipping right there in the shop. Tell you know now, if you beat your kids, they call the police. No sports unless you're on the first team. You can't make the first team, you come home, work with the team here at the house.
But he said tailoring was not his field. It was too hot, the work was too hard. He would help me, but he wanted to be an athlete.
Reggie Jackson was a guy deeply driven by insecurity. Reggie Jackson only wanted to prove one thing, that I belong, my father accepts me, and I'm going to be the best of anybody who's ever played the game.
He chose baseball over football at Arizona State, and then was the second overall pick in the 1966 draft. Introduced to the South, playing for the Birmingham A's the following year.
I begged not to go to Birmingham, Alabama. I'm not going there. I couldn't eat with the team there. I couldn't sleep in the hotel. I couldn't live there. But at least in the South, you knew that they didn't like you and didn't want you.
He was in the A's minor league system only because the Mets, with the first pick of that 66 draft, had passed on Jackson because, his coach told him, they thought he was dating an Hispanic woman.
You know, I was angry. I was an angry dude. And, you know, being of color in that era was a different world. And, you know, and it's something that you don't really care to express to a lot of people about.
But for Reggie Jackson, his racial identity was never something he could escape. At the ballpark or on the street.
My wife couldn't stand it because I had to say hello to people and I had to be nice to people. And if you don't, you know, I'm a nigger that got, you know, a lot of money and don't care about nobody else. Who's he think he is? Or, you know, and that's what hurts me more than anything.
Drill down the right side. That's going to be a base hit. And the ball game is over. Reggie Jackson jumping on the first pitch from Hernandez.
On every swing, on every movement in the outfield, the fans were constantly focused on Reggie. And as he went, so went the Yankees.
Greg Nettles once said, the best thing about being a Yankee is getting to see Reggie Jackson play every day.
That's gone. No doubt about that.
The worst thing about being a Yankee? Getting to watch Reggie Jackson play every day.
We thought he would have been a great DH. We had better right fielders than him. But I think whether it was Reggie's idea or Steinbrenner's idea that he is a big investment to the ball club, and he didn't want to be seen just for 10 minutes a night.
Reggie could be hot and cold. Billy Martin didn't really want him, didn't bat him clean up where George thought that he should be hitting.
For you personally, there must have been several disappointments these first 4 or 5 months of the season. What have been the major disappointments?
Well, it's been very trying, but we knew when we put this team together that with the number of stars that were on the team, it would be very difficult.
George wanted Reggie batting fourth,
which is where, quite frankly, he belonged.
Reggie felt that's a player of his, and he used this word, magnitude, deserved to be.
But Billy, being Billy, batted in fifth.
Billy would always say to me, I like Reggie Jackson. Ray, I like Reggie Jackson. And he didn't like Reggie Jackson.
Billy, he wanted to be the manager, the general manager, and the owner. He just wanted he wanted to be in charge of everything.
How
How was he as a person? Was not a good person. But if you knew where Billy came from, his mother was a prostitute. She came home after school, and his mother was servicing men in their home.
The mother was very tough on Billy, banged him over the head with a frying pan a couple of times.
So think of a kid growing up, you have that in. Your mind has to be warped.
He was brooding. He was dark. He was angry. He was a brawler. He was a boozer.
Billy had mastered the game. It was everything else he struggled with.
If there has been any weakness in him, it has been from the time the game ends until the next day.
He lived in the bars at night and regularly showed up late to the park the next day, filling out his lineup card hours after every other manager.
Off the field, he was getting the stuff. I mean, you know, the drinking got to be out of hand at times. And as the season went on, you can see him kind of deteriorate a little bit more and more with not taking care of his body and himself.
There was a lot of incoherence, and he was a menace to himself and a menace to the franchise.
I remember one time we were in Chicago, and he was not looking good. It was a hot day, hot doubleheader, and right away he starts chirping at the umpire. I think it was Nestor Shylock, one of the old umpires. But after a while, Nestor says, "Come over here, Billy." Billy runs out like that. He says, "I know you don't feel good, and I know you don't want to be here for nine innings. If I have to stay nine innings, you're staying nine innings. So I'm not throwing you out of the game. So get back and shut up." Billy didn't say a word the rest of the time.
Working for George, you know, and that battle between, you know, who's running the team kind of like thing, I think that had a lot to do with it.
Steinbrenner would call Billy on the phone in the dugout during the game. "Why don't you do this, that, or the other?" To the point that one particular game, Billy took the phone and ripped it out of the wall. "You got Picasso as your manager, and you're telling the guy how to paint."
Sometimes I think he managed to make Steinbrenner mad just to get George yelling and screaming at him.
"The burden of the proof and the burden of the challenge lies with Billy."
George put so much pressure on him. Drinking was his way of calming himself, which was not a good thing for Billy because Billy was not a very, very calm drunk.
Finally, in August of that 77 season, Lou Piniella and Thurman Munson went to George Steinbrenner and pleaded for Reggie Jackson to be placed in the cleanup spot.
And Billy somehow was walking down the hall and heard them all and burst in. And, "Oh, you guys are backstabbing me." It was ugly. But finally, Billy did it. And they started to win.
Jackson would finish the season with 32 home runs and 110 RBIs.
Reggie started to swing the bat. He started to heat up, and the team started to play real well. With all the distractions that was going on in New York, you know, the Son of Sam, the friction between the team, we started to get focused.
We got into September, and like the song goes, "Ain't no stopping us now."
The Yankees would win 100 games, outlasting the Orioles and the Red Sox in the AL East. As for the Dodgers, during that summer of 77, Mr. Consistent, Steve Garvey, had gone through the first serious slump of his career, batting just 205 over a 45-game stretch.
It used to be a joke. "Can we get Garb to say F-U-C-K? Come on, say it." I'd strike out. I'd come back in. "Come on, Garb, say it, say it." I said, "I'm not saying, you can't make me." And then one time I came in and we were struggling and, you know, couldn't get any hits. I came in and guys went, "Oh my God." They started laughing. And I think the next thing we scored 5 or 6 runs, so it worked.
The Dodgers won 98 games, taking the NL West by 10 games over the defending World Series champion Reds on the strength of superior pitching and a lineup with four players hitting at least 30 home runs each, a first in Major League Baseball history. And after Dusty Baker hit his 30th home run, Glenn Burke greeted him at the plate with what's understood to be the first high five in sports history.
First game of the playoffs, 77. We lost. They didn't play well. The next day, after batting practice, Lasorda closes the doors and he starts in. He said, I'm bringing in a sports psychologist. He's going to work with you guys. You know, and everybody went, oh, God. Door opens and in walks Don Rickles. And for the next half hour, Rickles was saying stuff in the locker room that you couldn't even get out of your mouth in Vegas. That's how bad it was.
1-2 the count to Bake McBride. He struck him out. The Los Angeles Dodgers are the National League champions, beating the Phillies 3 out of 4 games.
The ALCS would be a fight.
That ball's going to be over the head of Rivers.
The Yankees going to a fifth and deciding game with the Kansas City Royals. It was win or go home.
Brett went in hard at Nettles, and Nettles kicked him, and that's when the fight started. But the Royals lead 1-0.
For Game 5, Billy Martin benched Reggie Jackson, mired in a 1-for-14 slump in the series.
And then he told Gene Michael, the coach, to go tell Reggie that he's not playing today. And Gene Michael said, I ain't telling him.
It was at that point that Billy asked Fran Healy to tell Reggie that he wasn't going to play. Reggie took it like a champion. I can only imagine what he was feeling.
You benched Reggie Jackson because it was a lefty pitcher and he was struggling. Guys like Reggie always struggle, and then they hit 2 home runs and drive in 5 RBIs. That showed you how fakakta Martin was, how self-destructive that was.
I went out on the bench and grabbed a bat and sat down the end of the dugout.
He was cool, waited for his moment, and his moment came.
In the top of the eighth inning, the Royals led 3-1.
Gene Michael said, you're going to hit. And I said, well, why didn't he come tell me to hit? He said, you're hitting.
First and third, one out, and Reggie Jackson is the pitch hitter.
Reggie can turn this ball game around as look at Randolph at third base.
I was mad and pissed off, but I still wanted to do good for me. I got my folks looking and everything, and I wanted us to win.
Deep to center field. Otis comes in. It drops in front of him. It's trapped. Everybody is safe. And Randolph will score. It's a 3-2 ball game.
Reggie got the big base hit to get that inning going for us, and we ended up coming back.
Bouncing ball. Left side. Brett.
In the ninth,
throws high.
The Yankees would score 3 runs to take a 5-3 lead.
Ground ball to third. Nettles to Randolph. Double play.
At the most important time when it came out to winning, Reggie was there. Hey, if we're struggling, jump on my back. I'm going to take you to the promised land. And that's not something you say lightly, especially in New York.
The Yankees have won the pennant.
Just 5 months had passed since the release of Star Wars, the movie. Now, in October 1977, in Hollywood and beyond, it was tempting to see the Yankees as the evil empire, George Steinbrenner as Darth Vader. The Dodgers, by contrast, were the homegrown underdogs, their Brooklyn roots fused with their Hollywood appeal. So the 77 World Series would be a meeting of two famed franchises, a rivalry that had evolved to become East versus West. There was history, there was symbolism, a city cloaked in graffiti, a coastline bathed in smog, the differences in plain sight, the resemblances just as significant.
The Rich Eisen.
Eisen Show.
I love a journeyman quarterback. They always got a nice tan. Like Steve DeBerg. Steve DeBerg. He was the Magnum P.I. He was the Magnum P.I. of the Steve NFL. DeBerg. He played like 38 seasons.
Yeah, he was pristine.
But the thing was, for 38, whatever seasons, probably like 20 seasons, he was always ready to go.
Right. The Rich Eisen Show. Weekdays from noon to 3 Eastern on ESPN Radio, ESPN Plus, and on Disney Plus. Evan, Canty, and Michelle are unsportsmanlike.
Rocky IV is amazing. The scene where he's in the car driving after Apollo Creed dies, and he's so upset, obviously. Oh, yeah.
Spoiler alert.
I need to have put a spoiler alert on that.
I've never seen it.
2025.
I never saw it.
Michael B. Jordan did 3 movies as his son living after the dad died.
Guess I don't need to watch it now.
The movie's 40 years old, Smoltz.
For some of us, it's brand new.
Unsportsmanlike. Weekday morning starting at 6 Eastern on ESPN Radio and on ESPN2. Evan, Canty, and Michelle are unsportsmanlike.
With Seattle, the only question around the quarterback is not with his physical ability, but it's with his ability to avoid those self-inflicting wounds if, in fact, things don't go his way for the majority of the game. This is a group that has something special. The quarterback is a big part of that. I believe the Seattle Seahawks can represent the NFC, bar none, hands down.
Unsportsmanlike. Weekday morning starting at 6 Eastern on ESPN Radio and on ESPN2.